Okay, we're on page 4 to start this evening, as far as my calculation is. So we are going to be looking at the condition of Adam at creation. And remember, Adam was created. After that, there was procreation. And so God just set things in motion. And so it was a... That's extra. So, anyway, Adam everybody after Adam was procreated. But what was Adam like when he was created, when God created Adam? What was true of Adam, you could say, was true of Eve also. But when Adam was created, we can look at it both negatively and positively. Negatively, he wasn't righteous or holy, nor was he unrighteous or unholy. But the term that we used to describe Adam at his creation was he was all moral. And you can see that when we look at the beginning back there in Genesis chapter 2. And as we go back there, we'll see that Adam was... Adam was created innocent, and Eve, being built from him, was the same way. And it was all, they were all moral, though. There was nothing good or bad, or bad or good. I mean, it wasn't righteousness and holiness were not an issue here. And as when you get into dispensations, they were innocent, and so, but they were all moral, and so there was nothing. Couldn't say they were good or bad. Now you have a tree in the middle of the garden in chapter 2 of Genesis in verse 17. And verse 16 said that they could eat from any tree. And so we'll pick up in verse 16. And Jehovah Elohim commanded Adam. And remember, it is Adam up until chapter 5 and verse 2, where they got it reversed around, but where it deals with mankind. But he commanded Adam, saying, "From every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat." And so really it makes it emphatic if you were to look at it in the Hebrew as eating, "thou shalt eat." And so you shall eat. But they would eat of every tree. But, and so now you have that but in there, there's an exception. But from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, a good that was a good that could make them happy, and the other was a evil, it was calamity, thou shalt not eat from it. For in the day that thou eatest therefrom, dying thou shalt die, is the way it really says it. And so dying they would die the day that they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So they had no knowledge of good or evil. They were all moral. And so good and evil were not an issue with them. They didn't know anything about it. But at the day that they ate from that tree, they would have that knowledge. And so there was no knowledge of that. Now go down to verse 25. And we come down to Moses' editorial comments in here, as Moses inserts his comments, and he says, "And they were both naked." And so this is from Moses' viewpoint. They didn't know they were naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. I mean, they were naked, but they weren't ashamed. And so there was no shame to their nakedness. And so this was, and yet we're going to see that they weren't totally naked. They were naked as far as Moses, from Moses' viewpoint. But we're going to see that they're stripped later on down the chat in the next chapter. They were stripped of something. So they did have some covering. But from Moses' viewpoint, they were just naked. But yet we could look back at it and we could say that they had a garment of light, because they were stripped of something. And it would be either a couple of the terms we're going to look at in a little bit here. But in chapter 3, verse 5, when the serpent comes, notice what he says to the woman, to Eve, "You shall not surely die," in verse 4. "For God doth know that in the day ye eat therefrom, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as Elohim." And did your translation change that to God? Yes. You'll be like God?
Yeah, you shall be like God.
Okay, so that was good. It wasn't God's. And so you shall be as God, and that's the way it should read. And so you'll be as Elohim. You'll be as God, knowing good and evil. And so Satan recognizes God knew the distinctions between good and evil, and evil came into the universe with Satan, with the one behind the serpent. And so you see that there, but you'll know good and evil. So they didn't know good and evil. There was no knowledge of that at all. Now down in verse 22, we see in Jehovah after the fall, and now they're covered with skins in verse 21, but from Moses' viewpoint they were not ashamed, though they were naked. And in verse now why would they be ashamed? Probably because Jehovah came to them. That would be why they would be embarrassed, I guess, or ashamed to be naked. I don't. They wouldn't be with one another, probably. But Jehovah did come, and there were other creatures around. And so, and apparently they could speak in such some because the serpent spoke, and Eve didn't fall down in a fright. So I don't know for sure, but that's. But anyway, now they're clothed with God clothes them with skins of animals. But in verse 22, and Jehovah Elohim said, "Behold, Adam is become as one of us." Another good Trinitarian verse, looking at it from the eyes of the New Testament. But how did they become as one of us to know good and evil? So we come back to this good and evil thing. Now they do know good and evil. So now they're no longer amoral. Now they're no longer innocent. Now they have been put to the test and they have failed. And so now Adam and Eve have fallen, but through Adam, his race is now going to be a fallen race. But now they know the difference, though, between good and evil. And now, they're going to get kicked out of the garden. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also from the tree of life and keep on eating and live perpetually into perpetuity. Olam. So go on living. And so they were kicked out of the garden, as we see there. And so there was really the only standard that there was, and they didn't know what good and evil was, but they just weren't to eat from that one tree. And now that seems like a pretty simple rule. And so the rule for the dispensation of innocence was a very simple rule: don't eat from the tree. Now, it's interesting, they didn't have a fallen nature. But one of our enemies, Satan, through the serpent, and he's identified as the serpent back in Revelation 12, and so you can see that that the serpent was Satan, the connection there. But Satan did come, and he worked through the serpent, this beautiful creature, to convince Eve that this wasn't a bad thing after all. And so she ate, and she was deceived thoroughly. Adam wasn't deceived at all, but he did partake. And when we get to the fall, we'll come back to some of that. I need to move on. Now, positively, when Adam was made, he was made good. And so when he was created, and when God made Adam, Adam was good. And you can see that back in chapter 1 and verse 31. And this is after the 6 days of creation, before God rested. That is when he ceased from his creating, from his work. And that's how he rested. He ceased from his work. And so you notice verse 31, and God saw that everything that he had made. And so this is that saw. He made, he fabricated everything he made or fabricated. And behold, it was very good. And so this was on the sixth day, but everything was good. And so that included Adam and Eve. Adam with Eve, with all it was, all the makeup to build Eve out of Adam. It was all good, everything, as well as everything preceding Adam. And so it was good. And so that's the thing that we see. You can see that everything was, it was good. That was how he was created positively. And so he wasn't righteous, he wasn't holy, he wasn't unrighteous, he wasn't unholy. But when God made Adam, he was good. He created him in innocence, and he also created him as one who was an intelligent being. Now, when they speak of evolution, it's kind of a devolvement, not rather than things evolving into better and stronger and better. I think we would have to say, if we really, really could observe Adam and put him to the test that people are tested today for intelligence and things, he was highly intelligent. He was good. And instead of evolution, it's been a devolution. It's been a devolution in effect. It's gone downhill from Adam, no doubt. And we can see that he was intelligent because he's just getting acquainted now with other creatures. And so when we come over to chapter 2, and look at verses 19 and 20, this is where there was no counterpart, no help meet, no, it says, but no counterpart for Adam in the previous verse, in verse 18 at the end. But then verse 19, and out from the ground Jehovah Elohim formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam. And so that's interesting. I have a center column here. It says, or the man. But his name was Adam. And so you have man all over the place, and now they translated it Adam, which they should have done to be consistent, probably. He brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And so he's going to call names upon them. And so there are lots of creatures, and he's able to name them with suitable names. And so he wasn't stupid, and he wasn't some kind of an ape-like creature or something that was less than, that had to develop into something smart through his race. He was smart. He was intelligent. He was highly intelligent. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, and the word creature in this is the word nephesh. We pointed that out back in chapter 1. You can see it over there in verses 20 and 20, you have it anyway, and verse 21, yeah. And so you have it back there, but the word nephesh used of creatures. And so that's why we translated at the end of the living soul. He became a living soul at 2:7. He became a living creature. And so as we come over here, though, he called every living creature that was the name thereof. And so that whatever name he gave it, that was the name of the creature. And Adam gave names, or he called names to all cattle and to the fowl of the air and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an helpmeet. There was no counterpart, one who was corresponding to him. And so that this is when God built Eve out from the side of Adam. But he was able to name the animals. He wasn't created as an infant. He was an adult, and so he was well formed. We don't need to argue whether he had a belly button or not. People would have wasted time arguing that. He had the appearance of age, didn't need a belly button, but it doesn't matter one way or the other. But he was mature. And so when you come back to verse 15 of chapter 2, just notice what it says here. And Jehovah Elohim took Adam and he caused him to rest. And when it says he put him into the garden, it is a rest, but it's a rest without labor is the kind of the idea of put him in the garden. How did they translate it? They
put him in the garden.
So they stuck with the old King James translation, put him into the garden. But it is a verb that would have the idea that caused him to rest in the Garden of Eden. But this is the kind of thing that was kind of good. He had things to do, but he was caused to rest in the garden. This thing that he was doing in the garden. So he was caused to rest in the Garden of Eden to dress it. Now the word dress here is here to till it, to serve it, and so we might just say to serve it and to guard it. And so here was a labor, here was a work that wasn't tiring. It was a restful labor. Yeah. And so it wasn't before the fall. This was nothing difficult for Adam. It was something that, this is the kind of thing, if it hadn't happened, you could go to work and you could rest and get accomplished what you need to. But he was caused to rest into the Garden of Eden, but he was there to serve it and to guard it. And so anyway, God put him over the garden, and then he gave him the instruction about the eating of from the tree. But he was mature. He was able to care for the garden. And when it came down to the test, though, that God placed before him, thou shalt not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Thou shalt not eat from it. That when the test came, he didn't act right. And so he didn't act right, and when he was put to the test. And so the condition given was that he would live until he ate from that tree.
Just a quick question. For the benefit, if you were telling someone else, you have in here, he wasn't created righteous or holy, I understand that, but then you say made good. For a lot of people, they wouldn't understand the difference. How would you distinguish that from the Tov in the Old Testament? As good as it mean, as in... Is it like Agathos, using it in that sense?
At this place, there was nothing wrong with the creation. I think you could say it was good in the sense that it was, and I don't think you have anything that would cover for Kalos, but ordinarily Tov, I think, would have more the idea of Agathos.
Okay.
But this could have more the idea. It wasn't good in the sense that everything was good, in that there wasn't anything wrong with it. It was what it should have been. Maybe that would have more of the Kalos idea in 131. I'm not sure. I mean, but I don't recall a word that Tov was Tov.
Yeah, because there's only.
And so it would cover both concepts. It would have to. So I would take it that way.
Yeah, I was thinking Collins would be close because he's proper. It was not.
Yeah, it was the appropriate. It was noble. It was a suitable thing. It was good, good appearing. It was what it ought to be. And it was just. And so, in other words, when it was good, it wasn't bad. It would be the opposite there of Kakos or something, or any word that had any concept of being flawed in any way. And so. The fall not only affected Adam, but it affected the creation, obviously. And so the creatures were affected by it and so forth. But anyway, that would seem to be the case. I think it would have that concept.
Yeah, because I think that's something
that
I think probably a lot of people would have some trouble understanding, because it's so much... We have the mishmash between good and right. And
now, when you get over to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, now that's moving into a moral realm, kind of, almost. I mean, it's in a sense of what's good for you. You're going to be happy because things are going good. It's good in that sense, but it is what you do. If you do it, what's right, it's good. It'll make you happy. If you don't, then it's calamitous to you.
Yeah, I think it does get closer.
And so it kind of moves more into more of a moral kind of an area there, because if you know what's right then, and wrong, and so good and evil would come on into would ultimately carry over into that knowledge.
Yeah, because I've always wondered exactly where Tov stood, because there's one word there, but there's two in Greek, and so there's...
Now that's something I haven't done, was to go back and see how the Septuagint translated it, which is not dependable, but it does see how they do it.
Yeah, that would be something to see.
And so that might give some idea how they understood it before the Lord's era on earth, and that kind of thing. Now, when Adam was created, it says he was created in the likeness of God, and he was created in the image of God. And I want to go back and look at that for a moment. But keep your finger here, and let's just go back and look at Isaiah chapter 40 and look at a couple of verses there. Isaiah 40. And we'll look at 18 and 25. Now, these are verses I always use when going through the doctrine of God. These are very applicable verses. But here you have the likeness, the term likeness used. And so this one is demuth, which is the Hebrew word demuth. And I did put those on your page here. But anyway, to whom then will you, he's asking Israel, will you liken God? And this is the verb dama. And it does have the idea to compare him to. Who would you liken him to? Who would you compare God to? Or what likeness? Now, this is the noun demuth. What likeness? Similitude. And so this looks at something. If you were going to make a pattern or make a model of God, what would you make it like? What would it be similar to? What likeness will you compare unto him? And then you have another word. The word compare is to arrange in order, or to put to. How would you put it in order if you were going to make God like something? What would you make? How would you arrange it if you were? What would you arrange to be like him anyway? What would you compare him to? Is bring kind of does give us the understanding of it. And then down in verse 25, to whom then will you liken me? Or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One. And so here you have this concept of likeness. And so if you're going to make something, if you're going to make an idol, then what are you going to make it like? How are you going to liken it to God? What are you going to make it like? Well, we know from Romans 1 the kind of thing that men did. They made it like the creatures. And so he made it like man, like birds, and like reptiles and whatever. Quadrupeds, they made it like all sorts of things. But anyway, that's how they made God. That's what they liken God to. But what are you going to liken God to? So it goes on to describe the man who's making a workman making an idol. This is kind of an interesting chapter, though. This is where he speaks of the circle of the earth in verse 22 and all of that. That's kind of a different thought there. But anyway, back to Genesis chapter 1, though. Who are you going to liken God to? Well, when God created Adam with all that was necessary for Eve, he created Adam in his likeness. But he says in our image. And so it's the likeness of deity. And so it's in likeness of the Trinity in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26. And God said, let us make. And this is that verb asah, which is to fabricate, to make Adam in our image after our likeness. And let them have dominion and so forth. The thing I want to focus on, though, is the idea of image after our likeness. And then in verse 27, and so God created Adam in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Now, as we look at these two words, the word likeness is going to have, is the word translated image. I need to consider image first, the terms for likeness. Demuth describes something that is like in the sense that it's similar. Or not similar, it's the one that it is similar, yeah. But it's a resemblance. And so it gives a resemblance, and that's the word we're looking at. It is the likeness. I'm fumbling around here. Image is not this term, but this is the term for likeness, though, for the likeness. And so that's the thing I'm looking at is demuth. And so Adam was similar in some way to God, demuth. And it occurs 24 times as a noun, 29 times as a verb, and twice in Daniel and the Chaldee. But I want to look at an illustration of it before we look at it further and go back to 2 Kings chapter 16. In 2 Kings 16, you do have a description, a usage of this that gives us some help in seeing what it was like. It's translated back here, pattern. You have fashion and pattern. You have two different words that are used here. And the first one is translated in the Hebrew is translated fashion here, but I don't know that they got them translated in order here to the Hebrew. But anyway, let's read the verse. And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it. And so the fashion of the altar in the Hebrew, the first term is demuth. It's the word we find in Genesis 1:26, likeness. And so the likeness of the altar, and then the pattern of it is Tavanith, I guess you would say it, but it's a structure. It's the manner in which something is built, or just a model. And so he sent a model of it according to the workmanship thereof. And so there was a likeness. He sent the likeness, though, so he could see what it was like. And then he sent a model that he could a model to him also. And anyway, the king was come from Damascus, and the king saw the altar, and so on and so forth. But anyway, that's one place where it's used in a different sense of something being a likeness to something. Well, Adam was like a pattern. There was a similarity between Adam and God and deity in some way. Now, Adam was not a little god, as some of your cults believe, and such. We know that he wasn't didn't have a little spark of divinity in him. So, he was like God. Now, we also have this term in the New Testament, homoios, and homoios means like or similar. Something that there's a resemblance of some sort with this term, and so let's go back and pursue this. We'll leave Genesis for a moment and consider the term in the New Testament that would correspond to this one. And so we'll go to John 9, the Gospel of John, chapter 9 and verse 9. I always like this passage because I like this guy in John 9. I just really appreciate him. And it's quite interesting here, John 9 and verse 9. And so this is what others say about him. And so the Lord gives him his sight, and he'd never seen before. He was born blind, and so the Lord gives him sight as the one who's the light of the world. But in verse 8, we'll pick up there, and the neighbors therefore, and they which were before had seen him, that he was blind, said, "Is not this he that sat and begged?" And this is asked with that little negative particle, "ook," and it demands a positive answer. Yeah, it is. It's him. And so some said, "This is he." But then not everybody was going to use that "ook" when they said that. Others said, "He is like him, homoios. He's just somebody similar to him." But he said, "I am. I am. It's me." And so it's similar, though. And that's how this word is used in the New Testament. Now, one other illustration would be 1 John 3:2. "We shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." And so we will be homoios, like him. And so even though now we are the born ones of God, look at that again, we are the born ones, not sons of God. Did they change that in the
that says new... children of God?
It is technon, that's what I was looking for. Okay, so they did correct that in the New King James. "Beloved, now are we the born ones of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." So we will be like him. Now, Adam was like God, and there is one way we'll see how he was like God as we look at this term. But the interesting thing Adam continued to be like God, and the race has been like God, but there's going to be a total change. In one sense, in a sense, man is like God, but we will be like Christ. We're going to be like God the Son in the future when we see Him in His human nature as He comes as the God-man. We're going to be like Him when we see Him. And so there's going to be a real similarity, not an outward appearance. But this is not an outward appearance with Adam either. Adam's likeness to God wasn't, they say, it's not a physical likeness. It definitely could not be a physical likeness because God as deity does not have a physical body. John 4:24, God is spirit. And so God is spirit substance. And so if you could see God, you would see he is spirit. And yet he covers his spirit substance with light as a garment. But yet you could not see him. He isn't physical. And so this likeness is not physical. That's one thing we can say at the beginning of this. And so Adam was created in the likeness of God, which set him apart from the other creatures. And so there's some way that he was different than the rest of the created beings. And he was quite different. Now, the one area of similarity was something that the animals didn't name themselves. The serpent was able to speak, but Adam was a rational being. He had an ability to think and to reason. And so he was a rational being with a human spirit. And so that's the difference, and that I believe that's the difference. He wasn't spirit. Adam wasn't spirit, but he had a spirit. And so we all have a spirit. We have a spirit. We're rational beings. And the rest are nephesh. They're creatures, but they are creatures without a spirit, without a ruach or without a pneuma, without spirit. And so the animals, they are soulish and not rational, but mankind is rational. And so he was a rational being with a human spirit capable of self-consciousness. And so man does have self-consciousness. Now, when we look at the parts of man, we'll come back to this verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11. But I want to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11, where you see that man has a spirit. He possesses a spirit. And we don't see that with the specifically with the animals, that they have a spirit. And so 2:11, he says, "For what man..." And so what individual man would you see here knows, and he knows intuitively, what does a man know? What man knoweth? And the way of the things of the man. I want to retranslate that a little bit differently. What man out from men knows the things of the specific man? And so you kind of have a partitive genitive here, an ablative, probably partitive ablative, separated out from mankind. For what man out from man intuitively knows the things of the man, of the specific man, save or except the spirit of the man, a specific man now, which is in him. And so you as an individual know what's in your mind. You know what's going on in your mind intuitively. Nobody else does. And so we may think we can read people's minds and things, but we don't always read people's minds.
Not very well, most
of the time. Not very well. And you may think something, and you may be very wrong in what you think about what they're thinking. But there may be something else that's going on besides what you think. So you don't know. But anyway, you don't know that. And then the verse goes on to say, even so the things belonging to God or pertaining to God knoweth no man. And so nobody knows the things of God but the Spirit from God. And so the Holy Spirit, he does know the things of God, being God. And so you could say the Spirit from God, since he was sent from God, or you could say this could even, sometimes I always toy with taking some of these as appositional, the Spirit who is God, that is God. And both would be applicable in a way, but he was sent, so I generally leave it there. But anyway, You see that man has a spirit. Now, man still has something else at this point in time. And back in James chapter 3 and verse 9, this is the verse that we see that man still is in the likeness of God. James chapter 3 and verse 9. James 3:9 is dealing in the context of dealing with the tongue. And we won't go back and deal with the tongue here, but he says that with therewith, that is with the tongue, bless we God. We can speak well of God, even the Father. And therewith, that is with the tongue, curse we men, which are come to be. It's not the word poieo, to make, but it's ginomai, which are come to be, or who are come to be, after the similitude, that is the likeness of God.
And the King James picks that up too, similitude.
What's that?
No, King James.
They say similitude. Yeah. And so they stuck with the King James, and that's similitude just means similar, likeness, and it is the concept point. It's homoios, and so there is the likeness. And so man still possesses the likeness of God, and the way that man is like God is man is a rational being. And that's so out of the all of the creation, excluding spirit beings who are spirit, man possesses a spirit. And so Adam was created with a spirit, and in that sense he was like God. And man still has a likeness to God. Now there are a couple of places where you have a little trouble with image, but the concept of image is not really an insurmountable problem. And later, maybe we'll touch on some of those when we get into the New Testament. But the image of God, there was something that Adam lost. And so an image, we come down to the term image now, where Adam was created in the image of God. So he was created both in the image and the likeness. So he still possessed the likeness. We see a verse that describes that he was created. And there it says he's created, that man is. Not just going back to Adam, he's speaking of mankind there as being created in the likeness of God. Now, as we come back to Genesis 1:26 and 27, we do see that God said, "Let us make Adam in our image, after our likeness." And then verse 27, so God created Adam in his own image, in the image of God created he him. We have one other reference to that also over in chapter 9 and verse 6, Genesis 9, 6. And so this is in the time of Noah. And so 9, 6, this is where you end up with capital punishment. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, now it is mankind, by man shall his blood be shed. And so this is going to set up government. You're going to have somebody who's going to have the rule to execute a murderer. And so, and the reason for this is, for in the image of God, and it says, made he man. And so, made he the man. And it is articular. He made the man. So it's a specific man. And so I don't believe it's mankind here. But he made, and it is also, he fabricated the Adam. And so you have, anyway, I guess that's as far as we need to go there. But anyway, but it was in the image of God that he fabricated him here now. And so, again, in the image of God, what would be the image? And when you look at the image, the concept of image, I put it here, it equals a representation. And so there was a representation. It occurs 17 times, and 17 times in the Chaldean in Daniel as well. But it's the Old Testament Hebrew term, tselem. Let's look at some illustrations of this tselem in Numbers 33 and verse 52. We come to an example. We'll look at a couple of examples just to see how image was used. Tselem 33:52. Now, then it says, and let's just pick up when they're coming into the land, it says in verse 51, "Speak unto the sons of Israel and say unto them, when you are passed over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then ye shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their pictures and destroy all their molten images and quite pluck down all their high places." So their molten images, these were things that were fashioned. And so you had a similar thing with the likeness in making idols back in Isaiah. In Isaiah 40, but it was a similar thing, but there was a likeness in some way, a similarity, but these were actually something that were visual representations here now. The images here, that's the emphasis. They were molten images, and so they were, again, things that they were idols. Both terms were used of idols, but these were the molten images. Back in 2 Kings chapter 11, again, we come to another place where we'll look at a couple of other examples of this, but 2 Kings chapter 11 and verse 18. And verse 18. Well, let's begin in verse 17 just to pick the immediate context. "And Jehoiada made a covenant between Jehovah and the king and the people that they should be Jehovah's people between the king also and the people. And all the people of the land went into the house of Baal and break it down. His altars and his images break they in pieces thoroughly and slew Mattan the priest and of Baal before the altars. And the priest appointed officers over the house of Jehovah." But anyway, they destroyed the house of Baal. But in the house of Baal were these images. And so the images were fashioned visual representations of their gods. And so, that, again, that's the concept. Back in Genesis chapter 5, we'll look at verse 3. Genesis chapter 5 and verse 3. This is quite an interesting one, because after the fall, Adam has his offspring, and verse 3 kind of gives you an idea of what mankind, whose image man bears now. "And Adam lived 130 years," in verse 3, "and begat a son in his own likeness." And so he was like Adam, Demuth. That's the first term that we looked at. But notice it was after his image. And so this is the Tselem term, after his image. And so after that, mankind, Adam's first son, after Cain and Abel, when Seth was begotten, he was in the image of who? Adam.
Yeah.
And so he was in the likeness of Adam. He was rational like his father. He was like his father in a lot of ways, but he was kind of a spitting image of him. He was an image of it. He was in the image of his father, and he called his name Seth. And so that gives us a place where we see it used, applied to man. He was no longer in the image, though, we'll see. Man is in the likeness of God, but we don't directly apply it, see it applied to the image now of God. Now, in Psalm 8 and verse 5, we've want to take a look at Psalm 8, 5 to this, with this image term. And so, 8:5, and this is a Christological passage here. It is a messianic. And so, in verse 5, let's just pick up verse 4. "What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels." And so when you're made a little bit lower, how was he lower? Well, the angels were up in the heavens, and he's down here on earth, but he made him a little lower than the angels. Takes on a little bit different concept back there in Hebrews chapter 2, but he says, and has crowned him. You've surrounded him with glory and honor. And so this is the kind of thing that Adam lost. Christ is seen here being crowned with glory and honor in his human nature. But he's been crowned, but he was made a little lower for a time as he came to earth. And so he was lower than the angels. And then he was made to have, and then it gets into prophetic things, made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands and so forth. But you have a bit of prophecy here. But Christ is going to regain what Adam lost in the fall. Was lower than the angels, but he's been surrounded in the future. It sees him surrounded now with glory and honor. Adam lost whatever he was surrounded with in the fall, and that's something we'll pick up on when we get back into that context again. Now, in Romans chapter 1 and verse 23, I want to look at the New Testament concept of image. I alluded to this earlier if you wanted to make God to be like something, what was the image they would do? It uses the image concept here, but they changed the glory of God in Romans 1:23. And so the icon is an image, it's a visible conformity to. And so in the New Testament does have more the idea of a visual conformity. It's a visual image. And so we could pick up the context, but we'll just jump right in and change the glory of the undecayable God, incorruptible or undecayable God, into an image. And so see here, it's an image. And then it's interesting, likened to corruptible man, decayable man. And so the image was likened to something, but it was to corruptible, decayable man, and to birds and four-footed beasts, that is quadrupeds and creeping things. And so that's how man likens the Creator.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it goes down to reptiles.
Oh, yeah.
And creeping things. And yeah. Hmm. Kind of interesting how it goes down. Now, is man still created? There are a couple of verses that might give you that idea, but we're not created by God, and that's clear from going back to Genesis 5, where we pick up that. Go back to before that to chapter 4 with Cain and Abel, and so he knew his wife. They weren't created, Adam, and so they weren't created. They were procreated, Cain and Abel, and then Seth, and then down the line, and so it was all procreation. And so Adam was created, and man is not created in the image of God today. There are some places I don't think we'll go back and look at those verses right now, but where it does speak of created, and it comes from the author's point of view when it's spoken, but we won't look at those at this moment. Now, I just want to go back and pick up. Now, it's true only if Adam and Eve before the fall that they were in the image of God. And so what was this image? When we stop and look at it, I think that we could say that the likeness goes back to the spirit realm, that God is spirit, but we can say that the image is not physical. Again, from John 4:24, God is spirit. And so God is spirit substance, so he doesn't have a physical body. But then when we look at Christ, we see that Christ is in the image of God, 2 Corinthians 4:4. And this is kind of a good passage, a lot of things in this passage, in this whole section here. There are other good things all over. But anyway, 2 Corinthians 4:4, it follows our gospel, the hidden is hidden to them, they're lost, in whom the God of this age, that they probably changed that from world to age in the New King James.
Yeah, God of this age.
Yeah, have blinded the minds, that is the noema, the workings of their minds, and then they believe not. And so he's blinded the workings of their mind, they can't figure it out, lest the light of the gospel concerning the glory of Christ. And so this is Christ's glory. It says the glorious gospel. You could say the glorious gospel. I think it's the gospel pertaining to the glory belonging to Christ. That's how I would handle that, the genitive there, who is the image of whom? He's the image of God. Should shine forth into them. And so Christ is in the image of God. And so Christ is, as the resurrected and glorified one, he's now in the image of God. Now when he ascended up into heaven, he had a glorified body, and he was the resurrected and glorified one. But as he's seated at the Father's right hand, he is in a state of glorification. And as he, and it's the good news concerning the gospel, pertaining to the glory of Christ, it is something that it's notice it says should shine forth unto them. And I believe there is this, there's a reason for the term shine here. It is shining forth, but it is going back to the fact that this glory that he has, he is covered with light.
Like the Mount of Transfiguration.
Yeah. And so the Mount of Transfiguration, he very definitely was transfigured, and there was a brightness, a bright shining, and so forth. And now as we go, we could pursue that. And on the Damascus Road, he was brighter than the noonday sun, and such. And you have the light, you have shining down in verse 6, for God, really it's not who commanded, but the one saying, and this is what he said, light, shine out of darkness. What has he done? He's the one who has shined in our hearts the light pertaining to the experiential knowledge concerning the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And so the image of God deals with something of the glory of God. Now, God's glory is his opinion of himself, but there was also that manifest glory, the glory that appeared in the tabernacle, later in the temple. There was a brightness and such. Well, we can see that is something of a brightness, though. But Christ is in the image of God, and that's the thing that we see here. Now, God is invisible, we're told over in Colossians 1 and verse 15. And Colossians 1:15. And it deals with his dear Son, in whom we have redemption through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins, who is the image of the invisible God. And so God the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn, and that is the firstborn here, having the idea of having the priority, the primogenitory. He's the one who's the rightful heir of all creation, not every creature, but all creation. And so that's the picture we see at this point in Colossians 1:15. So what is this glory then, that when Christ is in the image of God, and what is the glory of God that is seen? What is involved with this the term image then? We want to go back to Psalm 104. I'm sure we've all been back to Psalm 104 before. As we come back to 104, and we'll look at verses 1 and 2. Psalm 104, 1 and 2. And that's a psalm that gives a commentary on the creation. But it goes back here to Jehovah. Bless Jehovah, O my soul. O Jehovah, my Elohim, thou art very great. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty. And so there's something in this honor and majesty is going to define how God clothes himself in the next verse. Who coverest thyself with light as with a garment. So this honor and majesty, it's like it's light. He covers himself with light. And so God has a covering of light as a garment, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain, and then goes on some neat things in describing creation. But if you stop here and look at it, he covers himself with light, similar to a garment. Now, God is spirit. We don't have the eyes to see God. Spirit beings, maybe they can't see. They know that God is out there. They know the immensity of God. They know of the immensity of God. But God had to make a place where they could come, and where it would be his residency, where they could come, where God, where they would see and sense the presence of God, where God would reside, and making it his presence there, though he was omnipresent and though he was immense. He was everywhere at the same time. He was resident there. But yet if you could see God in all of his greatness and all of his glory, you would see a light. And that light would be enough to blind you as it did Saul of Tarsus. He just got a glimpse on the Damascus road. God just revealed it. Christ just gave a little glimpse of that glory. And so that's something that we see there. Now, did I leave this in your notes to compare Luke 2:9 and Psalm 80, verse 1?
No. So, is that now?
Luke chapter 2 and verse 9. We're going to run out of time, and I'm not going to finish what I needed to here, I guess. But
Psalm 80.
And Psalm 80, verse 1. And so, in Luke 2:9, you have some other references that would relate to light. And lo, an angel from the Lord came upon them. Not the angel, but an angel from the Lord. The angel of the Lord is the one who's there in the manger. And the glory of the Lord shone round about them. See, you have glory shining here round about them, and they were sore afraid. And so that's the one place where you see it in Psalm. In the 80th Psalm, we have another place. One time I did a forum paper on light, which was kind of a fun paper for me anyway. And Psalm 80, verse 1 says, O shepherd, give ear, shepherd of Israel, give ear, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest between the cherubim. And it says there, shine forth. So he dwells between the cherubim. And so there he was at this time he would be in the temple between the cherubim and the Holy of Holies. But he says, shine forth, emphasizing the shining forth. Now there's some other places. You have the pillar of fire and the Shekinah glory and the temple and the tabernacle. And I'll just give you some references where you see the glory. Exodus 16:10. 16:10, 24:16 and 17. Exodus 24:16 and 17. Exodus 40, verses 34 and 35. That's when the glory settled on at the completion of the tabernacle. Leviticus 9:23. Leviticus 9:23. Numbers 14:10. Numbers 14:10. Then we come to the completion of the temple in 1 Kings 8:11. 1 Kings 8:11. And so the glory now settles in the temple. And remember, they felt the priests couldn't go in because of the glory and such. Again, that's a deal. And then you move into the immensity of God, heaven, and so on later on in the context right after that. But then as you go on, you get to Ezekiel, and I just say Ezekiel chapters 9 through 11, you have the glory departing. And so there was a glory, a manifest glory in the Holy of Holies, and the priest had to smoke the place up so he wouldn't, when he looked upon it, he wouldn't die. But there was a glory in the Holy of Holies. And in Ezekiel especially, notice 11:23. And then in Ezekiel chapter 42 and verse 2, we see the glory referred to again. And so, did I get the right reference? I better make sure. No, I didn't. So I thought I'd better look that one up again. Nope. I got a wrong. I have a wrong reference there. Oh, it's 43. So you can put down Ezekiel 43 and verse 2. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east, and as it returns again. And his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. And then down in verse 4, and the glory of the Lord came into the house. So we can add some there. I need to make a change there so I don't lose route. Right across the page. Right? And so in verse 4, you have the glory. And then in verse 5, he says, behold, I'll just read it. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of Jehovah filled the house. And so this is the millennial temple. And so you have the glory returning in the future. And so the glory will come again. Well, we're going to have to stop at that point. And
so we're technically going to stop it.
We're going to stop at F, or E. E. Yeah. I hope to get through all of that, and I didn't. Not a good place to stop. We won't be back here till next year, so I don't know if we'll remember where we've been.
I was just thinking that Simeon, it's when Simeon said, "Letting your servant depart in peace," and so forth. It says, "A light to bring revelation to the Gentiles." I was wondering. I thought he said something in the glory. I thought he said something about the glory. But I guess it wasn't there.
Yeah. But there is a shining, but it's a light shining to the, and that light's probably going to come through the gospel and when it comes forth. But it's.
But I was thinking maybe it had said that. Who was it that said it was the glory of his people that he'd come? Christ. I can't remember what that is, but it seems that there was someone that said that.
Yeah.
I cannot remember that now. It struck me as the glory. I thought, somebody recognized.
Well, they were waiting for sure.
Yeah. I can't remember that ever. It seemed like there was a reference.
Right off the top of my head.
I can't remember. I'm so sure. Like, I thought, that would be the glory. That would be the display, the manifest glory of return.
Yeah.
The one that would have manifested glory.
I'm looking at the wrong place here, that's why.
I hate that when you're trying to remember something.
Yeah.
You can't find it, but you know it's there. Or at least you're sure it's there.
Well, he was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him.
I thought somebody,
and he wouldn't see death till he saw the Lord's Christ. Now it may go back into Zacharias.
Yeah, that's probably.
And that's where it would go into that long.
That's going to have to be what I took out. I know it's there. It just bugged me because I can't remember, and I thought for sure.
He's going to give light in verse 79 to them that sit in darkness and the shadow of death. That's about what he had to say. So it's not
the same thing. But I thought there was one that talked about he was the glory of his people when he came out. I'll have to go home and look that up because it's going to drive me batty if I don't remember this.
Okay. Well, we'll stop so you can move on into the evening. Okay, Father, we're thankful again for your word, and we're thankful for who you are, Father, that you are the great God, and that you do cover yourself with light as with a garment, and that you are most glorious beyond our imagination. And yet, Father, we're thankful that as we consider how great you are and how great your glory is, we consider also that you did send your Son to leave that glory in heaven, to become flesh and to tent among us. And as he did so, he was full of grace and truth. And we're thankful that as he came, he did accomplish his work on the cross. And he's risen and ascended, seated at your right hand. And one day he is coming back. And when we see him, we will be like him. And we will be covered again with what Adam lost. as we'll be like your resurrected and glorified Son in his human nature. And so we're thankful for that now. Again, as we move into the evening and move into the holiday period, again, might be a time of a blessing, and also might we have rest this evening and accomplish your will in the rest of the week. We think of Darlene once more. She's working, that she might be protected and be able to reflect upon her position in Christ and be encouraged as she has time there, and we'd be grateful for that now. Amen.